EMS on the Mountain is an entertainment, educational, and commentary product recorded by Sean and Mike and produced by them. Nothing recorded by Sean, Mike, or any of the guests of the show is endorsed nor authorized by their respective employers or agencies unless explicitly outlined. All commentary and statements made are their own. Always follow your respective medical protocols. Nothing said on this platform should be considered medical direction. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the EMS on the Mountain podcast, a show for those interested in austere and wilderness medicine. This podcast provides insight into the unique aspects and challenges of bringing modern EMS into wilderness and austere environments. And once again, Mike has brought us into an awkward entry. Welcome back to another episode of EMS on the Mountain, as usual. You have the Bill and Ted of Wilderness EMS, and I like that one.
That's hilarious. Yeah,
I'm not going to make us Batman and Robin or anything. We'll be the Bill and Ted of Wilderness EMS because we are totally awesome dudes.
We are totally awesome dudes.
Bill S. Preston, Esquire. Holy shit. So today's episode was developed by our friend Mike there, and he has a selection of topics and ideas, and I am completely blinded to them because he wanted a get honest reaction just off the cuff. And
I do want an honest reaction,
which I always give honest reactions, which is why we have some people that are grumpy with us and some people who are not. And 2 weeks ago, Mike and I made some really good friends. If you haven't read those comments, Mike, you should. You can always pick out the ones that are about us.
I adhere to the Joe Rogan model of commentary vis-a-vis don't listen to them. So if you're telling me there's comments I should go read, I'll go read them. All right. So in the theme of we're not good at making friends. Well, to be honest, there's been some discussions in the EMS world as of late about wanting to do more and wanting to have more advanced skill set and more capability. And I think to a certain extent, social media is getting in the way of this. I love the social medias. I love everything about the social medias. If I had to pick life with or without, that'd be a tough choice. Cause personally, I hate a lot of online life in general. I think we've lost a lot of human contact, but on whole, it's probably a net positive. But part of that means that there's a whole bunch of keyboard warriors that think they're rock stars at a thing because they took a class or they went and did an online tutorial on a thing. And then they feel like they can speak eloquently about a particular thing. So what the hell am I talking about? I'm talking about a lot of the high speed, low drag or high speed, high drag, advanced practice skills that you are seeing pop up all over the Instagrams and the Facebooks and the this, that's and the others. And for those of you that know me personally know that this is a somewhat near and dear topic to my heart, but I started thinking about a number of these pieces of equipment or diagnostic tools and whether or not they were applicable to wilderness medicine. So I've got a list here. Sean and I are going to talk about them sort of one by one. I do want to start off by saying, and I'm going to circle back to this at the end. Please keep in mind that the role of EMS, at least in my opinion, is to not fix things. Sometimes we feel like our job is to roll in and fix stuff. And a lot of the conversations about alternate destinations and dispatched for care at home and leaving the patient there and billing for that and all those things are predicated on the paramedic is just as good as the doctor. I would argue that when we, quote, fix stuff, when people, quote, get better after contacting us, that is largely related to the fact that it was a relatively benign and easy thing to solve for. EMS, the concept of pre-hospital medicine, holistically, there are exceptions, is largely to stave off death. and intervene in the little things and make it easier on people. But it is not to, quote, fix them and move on. And I want to explain that a little bit more in that we don't carry a bunch of diagnostic tooling that allows us to go in and remove a spleen or do surgery or fix this or that other problem. What we do is provide management of the situation and keep people from getting worse while we get them to a place that has more tooling and equipment to determine these things and fix them. Is that a fair statement, Sean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of stuff going around, I think with the intubation side of things, the people wanting to do RSI, change that to resuscitate sequence intubation. I think that sums up a lot of it. It's the temporizing measures, the stabilization of patients, the sick ones. Obviously, they're the not so sick that my belly hurts and it's because I ate too much Taco Bell at 3 a.m. And yes, if you're wondering, we do get those calls. Oh yeah, I totally agree. Off the top of my head, like how many things do we really fix? And I think the only thing we truly fix pre-hospitally could be low blood sugar. And that's still a temporizing thing, because unless somebody's been on like a starvation diet, which we're still not fixing that, right? They still need to go get proper medical care. That's not just a paramedic in a truck, right? Getting somebody's blood sugar back up to a normal range so they can mentate and then sign the refusal. We didn't fix the problem because their problem is a diabetic problem.
Their problem is they're diabetic.
their problem is the use of insulin in their system and their endocrine system. So again, it's still a temporizing measure. We fixed that one problem, but we didn't fix the problem. And so, yeah, I think you're spot on, right? There's really, yeah, we're not fixing anything pre-hospitally. That's why it's called pre-hospital, not hospital.
Not hospital medicine. Yeah. Okay. With that said, I'm also going to say flat out, I'm not opposed. I'm not for or against any of the things we're going to discuss here today. But I am for, I'm absolutely all in on the fact that if you're going to do more things, even if you're not going to do more things, that was a stupid statement. I'm going to retract that and say, even if you're not going to do more advanced things, as a pre-hospital care provider, you are absolutely positively responsible to make sure that you are providing the best care possible for your patients. So for all of you keyboard warriors out there that are telling me, oh, we need to be able to do ultrasound. Oh, we need to be able to do pericardial syntesis, blah, blah, blah. The list goes on. Are you going to dedicate the time, energy, and effort to make sure that you're maintaining that skill set? A lot of these things are, that we're going to talk about today, are life-saving interventions. I'm not completely convinced that they are going to be life-saving interventions in the woods, but that's what we're going to talk about. But if you're not working on maintaining the skill set on how to perform the activities, like that's part of the downtime aspect of being a pre-hospital provider. And if you're not going to put in the work, don't advocate for the cool guy stuff. There, I'll say it as about as succinctly as anything I've ever said. If you're going to advocate to do the cool guy stuff, you got to make the time, energy, and dedicate the commit the, or you've got to commit the time to maintain the skill set and be able to do it right in those high acuity, low frequency events where these skill sets come into play. So let's talk about the first one. You ready, Sean? Here comes the first one. Keep in mind, we're talking about the wilderness here. Intubation.
That my cue?
That's your cue. Should we be carrying around all the equipment necessary in performing intubation in a wilderness setting?
I think we're going to caveat this with the lead-in answer for probably everything you give me, and it's the, it depends.
Oh, Lord.
Here's what I'm going to give you, because context matters in this thing, like in the wilderness. What are we calling the wilderness? There's something being 50 miles deep somewhere is different than being a mile off a trailhead, right? That's maybe an easy carry out, right? So all that being said, I do believe there's still a case where the ability to intubate and provide that definitive airway is certainly warranted. I think it's a skill that if you're a wilderness paramedic, you should be up on your intubations regardless, right? Just because there is the need. Some people just need those definitive airways that a supraglottic may not get it done with necessarily. I think a lot of times supraglottic will still probably suffice a good number of these settings. As all the studies have pointed out pre-hospitally in the urban setting, right? So not much is going to change wilderness-wise. I think, and this is my personal opinion, we've had this discussion before, if you're going to intubate, you need to be somewhere very close to the trailhead already. You need to have compact portable ventilator. Because walking with the Stokes and bagging someone and not dislodging tubes and everything else is great in a training environment with a mannequin and things like that, where you're really not sure because you don't have real end tidal going on and you can't tell, have I dislodged this tube because the basket took a little bit of a pitch. I held on and went a different direction. Is the tube still in the right place? I don't know, but I'm squeezing the bag still. And the training exercise goes on. And in reality, you might have totally now come out of the airway, or maybe you shoved it farther in and it's now a right main stem. Who knows? And so walking and bagging, or going up the side of a litter and bagging somebody that's intubated. You and I both played around with these experimentally in training environments. Okay, if I'm with the basket and the patient, and which position is best for me to bag the patient while the litter is being raised or lowered? And it's really not, because you have several periods where essentially you're going to induce the apnea because you're not going to be able to bag, like when you're making your edge transitions and so on. So unless you set up like the ideal perfect setup with gantry cranes and shit that can just swing you over smoothly without you having to do any work. Yeah, great. So I would put the caveat of yes, intubations for the wilderness environment are a thing. But I also believe if you're going to be doing that, you do need to be working with transport ventilators. And this would go with supraglottics too. We'll put that any advanced airway, right? Mm-hmm. You need to be having some sort of transport vent. Something's got to be able to breathe for you, because you can't just walk right next to the patient with their head and bag effectively as you're moving. And I think you also need to consider the amount of drugs you're going to need, particularly on the sedation piece, right? The paralysis piece, right? Cool. Most of those last quite a while, depending on what you're doing. But are you going to carry enough to keep your patient effectively sedated throughout all of that? So there's, you got to remember that piece too. So again,
it's funny you mentioned that.
It's going to vary.
Oh, excuse me. That was a heck of a yawn. It's funny you mentioned that, because the next list was sedation. So I tend to agree with you on intubation. I'll give my thoughts on advanced airway procedures here in a second, but I think you already answered it. I think you have to be prepared for and versed in extended sedation of a patient if you're going to go down the road of intubating somebody in the backcountry. This can't just be only when they're unconscious. Lots of people, this is speaking from experience, unconscious people in the backcountry that are unconscious are either really messed up or they will become more conscious by the time you get them out of where they are. If somebody's been knocked out from a fall, you're usually with them long enough that they regain some level of consciousness, unless they're bleeding into their head and working on dying. Because if you're with somebody for 6, 7, 8, 9 hours, it's just how things work. Unless you keep them down, they usually come up at some point, right?
Yeah. And those that don't are on their way to permanent downness.
They're on their way to downs forever, right? And now we're staving off the dying, not working on fixing the dying. So I'm all for intubation. I think all of the exercises in paramedics shouldn't be intubating. I think we're being a little bit short-sighted and myopic in that. Kuruchu, again, the world's okayest paramedic. He's done a couple episodes on this recently. I think the numbers are skewed a little bit, but I think at the end of the day, if you have to manage an airway, the only way to get her done in the backcountry is to intubate somebody. And that means that you have to be versed in what a lot of what I'll call 911 systems are not really super super strong in, and that's keeping someone down once you've intubated them. So intubation comes directly with sedation in my mind, and it also comes, in my opinion, there's a whole level of how good are you at this and should you be doing it if you can't, but standing orders for cricothyrotomies is a must in my opinion, because if you decide you're going to intubate somebody and something goes terribly wrong and now you're in a bad way. Now I actually agree with this, right? If you're going to take someone's airway, if you're going to RSI somebody and then you have to cric them, you have failed so incredibly badly, because if you weren't confident that you could get the tube done, I shouldn't say incredibly badly. There's always the outliers, right? But it's a long conversation about, so you decided to paralyze this person and then you couldn't get the airway and then you had to cric them. Like, why did you choose to paralyze them? Perhaps you should have used other measures to manage the airway or position them better or prepare more effectively before you paralyze them. But a lot of severely injured falls and things, we're not in the business of paralyzing. We're just in the business of trying to maintain life. And in that case, you absolutely positively need to be able to intubate them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because you brought it up. In the world of this austere medicine piece, I personally, and I know this would go against what a lot of people think, but if you're truly in a backcountry, wilderness, austere environment that's not, we'll say, clinic-based, like offshore oil platform where it could be hours or days till a helicopter can come get your patient, but you have a small clinic, right? In the woods, and if you need the advanced airway and you think you really need to go the advanced airway, I myself personally would advocate going right to cric.
I'm not opposed.
Support that. And that's part of that is my background.
Yeah.
Where I learned advanced airway management from the people I did. And so I have a different outlook on that. And people ask me, but why? And it's in some ways it's more secure. Right. You still have to obviously pay attention to where your tube's at and everything else. But
yeah.
We're not going to get into all that. But anyway, so that's just a personal thought. You can do conscious crics, right? Enough ketamine down for a brief period. You do the cuts. You're bypassing all the things that are going to make people gag and vomit, essentially. The whole reason we do the paralyzation piece.
Yep.
So depending on your jurisdiction, the meds you have available, that might be your only option for a legit definitive airway. But anyway, enough on that.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay. So you mentioned it briefly, mechanical ventilation. I go back and forth on this. Let's get your thoughts first, and then I'll tell you why I'm pro and con depending on the day of the week that I'm thinking about it.
Again, if you are going to purport to have advanced airway skills and do an advanced airway, whether that's supraglottic or endotracheal intubation, I think you need to be having a transport vent, like small compact transport vents. Pick your model. I don't really care. As long as it does the job sufficiently for your needs, which includes battery life. Because again, we always talk many hours with some of these people, but I think some of the reality is, and again, it varies, but if we've had to intubate, this is one of those patients that we're getting out as quickly as we absolutely can safely. This isn't someone where we can overnight with this one if we need to, and we can try different methods in the morning, like maybe aviation can come in the morning, or we can assemble more people to make the carry out easier. If we're at a point where the patient's so bad that we've had to intubate, or we've had to put in a king airway and everything to manage an airway, and they're still down, then those are people that need to be getting evacuated now. And that doesn't mean that it's only a couple hours because we've got a helicopter that can come, because that still might not be an available option. So I think having a ventilator, 100%, okay, 90%, yes, it's mandatory. Can you manage without it? Yes, but as we've talked about, it's simply just not ideal. And then lastly, whatever you choose, you've got to be able to have the battery longevity to support the full mission with it. So that is what it is.
Yeah.
And I'll say, especially like you and I, unless we're going to get somewhere and then turn them over to a proper PEMS unit, local helicopter EMS agency, if we fly with the other agency that picks us up, they don't have a ventilator on their helicopter. They're not, it's not a HEMS helicopter. It's a helicopter that can be used for rescue operations. So right. You might need to have that vent work for hours on the ground and then transit time of flight, et cetera. So you got to be able to plan the whole mission with that.
Yep. I was actually going to bring that up at the end. So here's my take on ventilators. Twofold. One, I think that are an absolute necessity if you're going to be managing airways for an extended period of time. And I define extended period of time in EMS on whole as more than like 20, 30 minutes. I don't think the data is clear yet, but I think my understanding of pathophysiology and enough that I've read says that if you bag someone for more than about half an hour, you're probably doing more harm than you think you are. Right? I'm not going to say you're doing more harm than good, because not bagging somebody that's not breathing, obviously, has a guaranteed end game. There's a guaranteed output there. But at the end of the day, we're not very good as humans to paying attention to the nuance of a human that's in a bad way, more so than a ventilator. And this, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about different vent modes and whatnot, but I've been doing this a long time. I've been involved in bagging quite a few people, and I don't think anybody notices whether they're bagging over attempted breaths or overinflating or overbagging, right? There's so much education that goes into teaching folks how to not overinflate lungs and don't squeeze the bag too hard and two fingers and all these things, right? Some systems mm-hmm. have gone to pediatric bag valve mass, which I actually at first was like, that's a great idea. And then I read more about it and I was like, that's a horrible idea.
Yeah, Sam. Yeah, not for, yeah, anyway.
But all of those things are all an attempt to do a better job at managing the airway of a patient that's in need of airway management using a manual bag valve mask. The better solution for more than what I'm calling half an hour is probably a mechanical ventilator, mm-hmm. though there are complexities with those as well. What has me on the side of, this worries me, even if you're going to save two, which I do not think is bare minimum in personally for the proper care that a patient should be receiving. I think something like an EMV or a Zolt X-Vent, a ruggedized device that actually has multiple parameters and settings for more lung protective strategies than what you get from a simple mechanical ventilator, though they're a little bit bigger and heavier, is probably, now, under the do no harm, do best for your patient thing, did I say X-Vent? I think they're called Z-Vents, right? Z-Vents?
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with them.
Yeah, I think it's called a Z-Vent. I'm familiar with the EMV Plus. Anyway, there's a bunch of benefits. But with the tool, there is a significant amount of complexity that comes with running a ventilator. Like, knowing how to properly manage a ventilator is not like I did this once in a class and then I'm going to go do it in 9 months when this guy needs it. And the wilderness environment, truly austere or extended care wilderness environments, do not have the call volume that EMS transport and 911 systems in busy cities do, right? So being able to calculate ideal body weight and understand lung protective strategies and all the things and PIP and PEEP and all the stuff that there's plenty of podcasts on how to do. You have to know this stuff at a level that you're not going to do more harm. And that requires a significant investment in education. So I think they are a critical component for extended care, but it is also, if any particular system is going to invest in them, there is a significant amount of investment necessary to make sure that you're maintaining that skill set. So I'm pro ventilator, but I'm also reservedly concerned because a lot of folks simply don't have the time or don't commit the time to the educational refreshing and staying on top of the science when it comes to running things like ventilators for an extended period of time.
I agree with you 100% on that. And I would say all of your concerns are why the safety was built the way it is, right? It was built mm-hmm. for that. Mungo, think friend, 5'8", hit that button and it just does it. And then you can take off 10% of the projected volume for that and everything else, try and work it. But I think what you need to also consider is if you're going to go down the road of having transport vents, whatever model you choose, you also have to have the requisite patient monitoring equipment to do the job correctly. This is not where you could just toss an EMMA between whatever that vent set and your airway is, right? You need legit airway monitoring. You should probably be getting some cardiac monitoring so you can see spikes in heart rate and everything else that you're just not going to get using what we'll call traditional field or wilderness basic patient monitoring equipment. Like, this is where, like, the Athena, the WVSM, comes into play, right? Especially the new model that can do full capno stuff, right? Like, you need to be seeing these things. And it's best if you can put that on a screen, like if you had an actual Zoll or LifePak monitor, or you can start to see breath stacking and things like that on with your stuff, right? Because if your monitor isn't going to show you that, your vent, then you need something else that's going to show you that, so that you know that, oh, they're overbreathing, they're underbreathing, they're, I'm giving, still giving too much volume, or maybe I'm not giving enough volume. So I think the requisite patient monitoring that we take,
or do we have an oxygenation versus ventilation problem, right? Just because they're breathing doesn't mean they're oxygenating, right?
What I'm getting at is, if you can't do the full ALS level patient monitoring, I think just tossing them on a vent, even a simple one, as high speed as you want. If you want to bring your Hamilton into the field, I don't know what the battery life is for one not attached to a helicopter. Hey, good on you, but you need to be able to monitor your patient in its entirety, not just whatever vent you're using. That's like, the safety is only going to give you some high pressure, low pressure alarms. It's really not going to give you much else. There's no display to show you if things are working the way you think they're working. You have to be able to truly observe and monitor your patient. And so I think that should be a caveat we throw out is, yeah, I'm all about it. We should absolutely have access to some sort of ruggedized transport vent for advanced airway use in austere environments, but you do need to still be able to do full patient monitoring. If you're not, better than not having one, but at the end of the day, are you still doing the right things, and are you not causing that more harm thing?
Yeah, I'm with you. All right, ultrasound. Should we have it? Is it a tool that we should be keeping in the toolbar?
This is definitely another, it depends, right? So for what I will call short duration, we'll call it traditional 911 backcountry response, neat, but is it necessary? And I'm going to say no. Because if you're doing a good patient assessment, even with basic vital signs collection tools, right? Blood pressure, pulse ox, stethoscope. Doing a fast exam, if my patient took a fall and they're complaining of abdominal pain and I'm in the backcountry, my assumption is it's internal bleeding until a surgeon tells me otherwise. Now, if I'm working McMurdo Station in the Arctic, and do I call a C-130 in to evacuate this guy or not? Absolutely, using ultrasound to go, oh yeah, that's free fluid. We should definitely get them out. This is bad. So is there a need? Yes, case dependent, right? So should I carry an ultrasound in my backpack just to do a fast on somebody that took a tumble and I'm going to evacuate them to a hospital anyway? Is it going to give me info? Certainly. Is it going to change anything I do for them pre-hospitally? No. Other than ask for help quicker. But either the helicopter's coming or the carryout crew is coming, or it's not, or it's going to be delayed, whatever it is. The time frame is the time frame. I think the biggest difference in the austere environment is because we have that extended patient time, almost irregardless of the situation. It's not as big a deal. It doesn't really delay evacuation or transport like it often does in the urban setting, where people sit on scene for an extra 10 or 15 minutes playing with their ultrasound when they could have been damn near pulling into a trauma center at that point. Yeah, I mean, are there other good use cases for it? I would think, like, hypothermia. Is this dead or hypothermia? I can look at the chest. Do I actually have cardiac motion and movement? Yep, heart's actually moving. Not dead, just severely hypothermic. Let's do stuff. That could absolutely be useful. And of course, the usual checking diameter of optic nerves to see if there's intercerebral swelling and things like that. Like, neat. Yeah. But if they took a fall and they're unresponsive and they are still unresponsive by the time I get there, there's something going on in the brain that they need to go see a doctor about, right? It's cool. Is their brain swelling? I'm going to assume yes, because they're completely unresponsive still, or whatever the case may be. And again, this goes to your work in Everest Base Camp, right? Is this some cerebral edema due to altitude stuff? Yep. I don't see anything else crazy. Can you hang out here and be better? Sure, we can monitor it. But for average, we'll call it, again, the 911 style of wilderness EMS response, I think with very limited use case, it would be handy. Otherwise, I think it's just one more thing you're going to carry just to play with. And again, ultrasound is one of those tools that's been shown that you need a lot of sets of reps on to stay proficient. Yep. It's not something you can just pull out twice a year and go, I don't even know what I'm looking at here. And so, is that the liver or is that not the liver? Is that fluid? I don't remember what that should look like inside there, kind of thing. So if you're not good at your ultrasound interpretation, that's a tool best left behind.
So here's my take. I generally agree with everything you said. This falls directly into the ventilator category of, are you spending enough time doing maintenance training and education? This is the sort of thing where you got to get out, lube up, and ultrasound people at least a couple times a month to maintain proficiency. Because part of, at least in my limited experience, part of being good at viewing ultrasound is knowing what looks off. And you have to see enough people to know what looks normal to then start identifying what looks not normal, right?
Yeah.
I think it's got, I'm 50, I'm on the fence on whether fast EFAST exams in the backcountry are necessary. I think this couples with the next thing I'm going to mention, which is blood and access to whole blood administration. I do not think you should be pushing whole blood on people without a like clear traumatic injury, unless you can get some differential diagnosis, because there are some complications with pushing blood on people and things that come with it. But so if you have whole blood, maybe ultrasound is the thing you also need to maintain. Having whole blood is, administering blood's pretty easy. Maintaining the program is harder. That said, I think the place where ultrasound is somewhat interesting to me in a more wilderness environment is respiratory distress, right? Getting to a definitive answer around how urgent is this person? Is it an asthmatic attack? Is it this? Is it that? Do we have fluid in the lungs? But again, that's getting more into the austere environment as opposed to backcountry medicine problem. And then the other one for me, and this is so corner case and nuance, it's probably not even worth discussing, but I see a lot of use for ultrasound pre-hospitally in termination resuscitation efforts. I don't want to do a bunch of things to someone or to someone's loved one when they had an inadvertent cardiac event on the trail. I don't want to crack ribs and call in all the resources and all the things if I can get there in a timely manner and determine that it's probably not something we are going to be chasing.
Well, I would say it's actually more important, because we're 90% of the time, if we're talking actual backcountry, we're not going to get there in a timely manner. And we get there and there's already been 30 plus minutes of, we'll even assume it was good bystander CPR. We get there, check pulse, no pulse. You have a monitor, you don't have a monitor. Slap that thing on, zero cardiac activity, we're done. Hey, folks, appreciate your efforts. We're done. Or you see something, you're like, shit, because again, you're probably not going to have a life pack or a Zolt with you to like actually look at even four lead feedback. Is there electrical activity? You're not even going to really be able to play the PEA game, right? So it's, is there a cardiac activity or is there not? If there's not, that makes it very easy to then terminate the resuscitation, especially when you call med control because of a backcountry thing, because they're going to, what rhythms have you seen? It's like, bro, we have no monitor, but I have this POCUS device and I am zero cardiac activity. Then they're like, oh, right then. Go ahead, call it, time, fucking whatever.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to blood administration. Is that something that we should have pre-hospitally? or excuse me, backcountry. Well,
yeah, Safe-Free Hospital, absolutely. I'm a fan. So backcountry, yes. Again, caveats with that. So you get someplace, somebody's got your assessment and whatever you found, you're thinking, yes, this supports hypovolemia. They need blood products. And given that they might be still an hour plus, assuming that you have a helicopter that can hoist or something that's going to come, getting them the blood products could literally mean the difference between life and death.
Yep.
So is being able to even just 2, maybe 3 units of blood? Yes. But I have to look at that kind of as a programmatic whole. Is it worth, if you are, we'll say, an independent wilderness EMS agency and you're not based out of an urban system that already has a blood program, should a national park, for example, have a blood program? You'd have to really look at the use case of how many times a year would we legit use this? Because a lot of the patients we have that blood would be useful is primarily where you and I are at. There's not so much external traumatic injury where we can put a tourniquet on or pack a wound and stop the bleeding problem so that then when we give them the blood, it stays where it's supposed to be, circulating within the vasculature. Internally, I can't stop you, your abdominal bleed. I can't stop you bleeding into your chest cavity. And if I'm dumping 3 units in and all I did was bloat your stomach with 3 more units of blood, I gave it a good valiant effort, right? We tried, we did everything we possibly could, which should be done. But at the end of the day, was the cost of that blood worth just dumping it in because we still had to sit on them for 2 more hours before we could get them on a full evacuation pathway to a hospital or a trauma center, regardless of mode? So I think there's a lot of, I would say, triaging that would need to be done by the providers on scene to determine if this person is a candidate for blood or not.
I agree with that. Here's my take. I am pro pre-hospital blood for a number of reasons. One, I personally believe that we treat traumatic cardiac arrest completely wrong. We treat them like their heart stopped, but typically a traumatic event, like the one you and I had not too long ago.
Yeah.
That was more like the preponderance of damage was not survivable. No, but assuming it had been, right? If there was a fluid leakage problem, fixing the fluid leakage has a much higher propensity of saving someone's life than filling them full of epi and telling their heart to beat when there's nothing moving. So when I think about it from a, we should be doing as much as we possibly can, whenever we possibly can to save someone's life, then absolutely. Like, just on its face, like having a blood program sounds great. The problem is that administration of a blood program and the cycling of blood and the making sure you're not wasting it, you really have 2 paths, right? You can start just paying for it. There are services out there that will ship to you blood for the purpose of administration to people. That is an extremely high cost for most programs to maintain for the rare use cases. Blood's only good for about 2 weeks, give or take, depending on where you're getting it and how fast, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not like you stick it in the freezer and you get to use it 4 months from now. It's just not how it works. So at the current state of the science we're in right now, it's really hard for me to say we should absolutely have a pre-hospital blood program wherever possible for wilderness environments. It's expensive. It's about $500, give or take, anywhere from $500 to $1,000 per unit of blood when administered. And if you don't have a way to cycle it back into the system and have it used, you're incurring a significant expense to have it sitting around to probably not be used. This is where a pre-hospital evacuation system makes a lot of sense. So here's where I landed when I was thinking about this, my man. Where you and I play ball, I do not think we need a blood program. But I do think that given the opportunity, and those of you that work with us and listen to this podcast, you're going to hear it and go, that sounds great. It's cute. I do not think we should be keeping blood on hand. It does not make sense for the rare use cases where we would need it. I do think higher level providers like ourselves should have the knowledge, capability, and equipment to administer blood, and we should ultimately work toward having a system where if for whatever reason I cannot get a flight crew there, or I have to transport them using some of the other air assets we have that are not, as you had mentioned earlier, critical care flight transport systems. They are just helicopters with the ability to pull people out of a bad way, but they don't have advanced care equipment on them. I would ultimately like to figure out a way to be able to acquire the resources and administer them, but not manage the system, right? I don't mind keeping blood warmers on hand. I don't mind having Y tubing and filters and all the bips and bobs needed to administer blood, right? And I think the cost of maintaining that equipment is relatively minor. You're going to throw away your tubing more often than you're not. But in the rare case where somebody does need it and it is life-saving, if there's a methodology to get it to the scene so that it could be administered, awesome. The kicker is that those rare situations often don't include providers coming from other agencies that have the skill set or the ability to get to the patient and do the work. That's where we come into play. So for me, a wilderness environment with a blood system, absolutely, but I think it should be in a combination system where the blood would more often be used on the flight crew. But in the rare circumstances, we should have a protocol that says call for blood and that blood can be brought and we will have orders and procedures in place to administer the blood for those that need it to try to save their lives. That's where I landed.
No, and I would agree with that 100%. Like I said, should, like a dedicated wilderness EMS agency, which again, in the United States really is the Park Service, right? Should Yosemite have a blood program in and of itself? Probably not, right? Should a smaller park have one? Oh, even less chance of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You would really have to look at how many times in a given year would this be administered? And the answer for most of these places is going to be very seldom. Very,
very seldom. Very seldom.
Right? Yeah. Like you and I can think of, in the years we've been doing this, maybe
I can think
twice.
Of five times.
Yeah.
I think of a total of five times where I would have seriously considered and probably moved toward blood administration had I had it available. Right?
Right.
Of those five times, two of them lived, three or four
did not. Once every 2 years.
Right? Yeah. It's once every 2 years. The majority of people that I would have considered it for have passed. I don't know that blood administration would have stopped them from dying, but it certainly would have given them a better chance at living, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. If everybody could have access to a blood program, yeah, sure. Absolutely. Like one day when we can have dehydrated blood.
Awesome.
Yeah. We can have dehydrated blood and we just reconstitute it and push it. Like, cool, right? Where it can just sit on a shelf and it's relatively inexpensive. That'd be great.
What are you envisioning? Like you mix it up in your Nalgene and then put a special top on and hang it upside down? Like
absolutely. Just like
Miles back in the day.
Like you can get your French press for your Nalgene bottle. Similar, right?
Yeah.
It's French pressing blood. Built-in filter and everything. So you take out some of the
everything?
Some chunks. No clots. Yeah. So we're good.
Good to go.
Yeah, just like you have your any of the other dehydrated blood products that people have experimented with before, normally around plasma and platelets and stuff. But the problem with that is once you've dehydrated a red blood cell and reconstituted it, it doesn't really come back to being a real red blood cell to transport oxygen. And that's really the big deal behind whole blood. So if we just want volume expanders, then we could just pick plasma or plasma and platelets.
Yeah. But we don't need... The kicker is, and I think medicine's going to go this direction, we don't need volume expanders. We need oxygen carrying capacity. Right?
And that's where all the studies have shown is like just giving someone plasma, yes, better than dumping liters of normal saline. And I'm going to get on my soapbox again. Any of you assholes that are still out there dumping more than 2 liters of normal saline in anybody is what's wrong with you? Trauma patients. There are some other whatever use cases, but like those days are over, folks. Yeah, like seriously.
But follow your local protocols.
Yeah, if they're telling you to put 4 liters in, then go for it. Anyway, beyond that, I think some of these people that get all poo-pooed in the pre-hospital paramedic community, especially the social media ones, about, my God, we're giving pasta water and battery acid. It's like, dude, have you watched an ED dump normal saline like it's going out of style in a trauma patient before they get to blood? Like, we are but a drop in the bucket, people. Stop.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We absolutely are.
Not that it's good for your patients. I'm just saying. Quit panicking. Your one bag of normal saline is not going to take them from a 7.35 down to a 6.0. Just get over
it. No, we're going to talk about that in a minute, but that ain't happening with normal saline.
So blood, absolutely, but I think you're right. I think it's much better done in a coordinated partnership sort of agreement with local agencies that have blood programs. Like, hey, if we have this super trauma patient that I need blood, can I call on you and we can arrange some sort of link up and we can get your blood, or your supervisor, whatever your provider, can officially hook it to the bag and the line and go, whatever that is. But I think that is definitely the way to go for most wilderness EMS programs.
So it sounds like we're pro-blood administration, we're anti-keeping it on hand. That's a partnership problem.
For most U.S. use cases, I think yes, correct. Because there are some places I know where wilderness EMS is taken care of by the local EMS teams, like the actual 911 ambulance crews. They just also do backcountry stuff. That's a different
fair
situation. So anyway, next.
All right, here's one I stumbled across, and then we'll get into some fun ones. I just want to know your opinion on this one. Pericardial synthesis.
Dude, so this used to be like the dream gig, like a paramedic. Yeah, man, I'm going to suck.
Yeah, but then we got ventilators and ultrasound, so it's not that cool.
Yeah. It's cool. Here's my concern. Is it something that could be potentially life-saving, again, in that maybe traumatic arrest scenario? Possibly. But this goes back to your other argument about vents and everything else. This is a very high risk, very low use skill, right? Like, how do you, this is one you can't even hardly train for, right? The simulators for it would almost make it so canned because, oh, I go in the same holes everybody else has used, right? Let's look at the studies done on needle chest decompression and how people keep fucking that one up. And now we're going to go at the heart with a giant needle that sits between two lungs and everything else. Personally, if you work for an agency that you can do this and you use maybe ultrasound guided, which I would say would be almost be the only way you should be doing this pre-hospitally, sure, that's cool. Could this be a life-saving thing or at least a serious temporizing measure? Absolutely. But to just blanket make this a, this would just be a wilderness skill, I think it's pushing it just because there's so much you can mess up. If they don't need it and you stab the heart, okay, that was a good idea. Like doing a minor pneumothorax on someone isn't so much, it's not good, but usually doesn't create a whole lot of harm on that patient. But accidentally inducing a hole in the heart when it didn't need to be there can be a big deal because that's a high pressure system and stuff will squirt out that hole. And it makes it harder for it to stop, depending on where you mess that up.
So, yeah, I personally don't think there's enough need for it. I think that limited training time needs to be spent on other things. It's cool. It's neat. But if that's your problem, like, you've had a good run.
Yeah. If that's the only thing that's keeping you from or preventing you from living, man, yeah, sorry.
The COVID vaccine, or I'm just kidding. That was a joke for all you out there.
I think part of this difficulty is going to be legit diagnosing it too.
I agree.
Again, people have a very hard time diagnosing no shit tension pneumos, the only thing we decompress in the field, right? Listening for muffled heart tones. Holy crap, man. Is that muffled heart tones or is my stethoscope suck? Like how loud should this thing be right now?
Probably you muffled heart tones. Yeah.
That's the thing, muffled heart tones. Plus, if I have to look, are they Bradian? Is there, what other vital signs am I looking at that normally you would look at and go, this could be a pericardial tamponade kind of situation? Holy crap, man. We're not, okay, 90% of us aren't bringing all that to the field in the wilderness austere environment. So I just think that's a
let's
very
talk about
high risk activity.
Let's talk about decompression.
Yes.
I think you and I are both going to be in the, needle decompression is the thing that's absolutely necessary when it's necessary. It's just that you got to not suck at it. And it turns out you got to be really clear that you need it.
And yeah, again, that one's certainly a skill that every paramedic should be maintaining. Training. I hate the training because it's usually so canned. You have that one mannequin and it's got 1,000 needle marks from where everybody's done it. And most of them are wrong. And when you've got to actually go in and put it in the right place because you actually know your anatomy and know where midclavicular is.
That's why I do it to my friends. Midclavicular. I train my friends.
Yeah. No. Needle decompression, sure, 100%. And this is one of those situations in the wilderness, not austere environment, because it does take us longer to get to a patient. You might actually start seeing the tension physiology where most pre-hospital guys usually really don't.
They usually don't.
Because the tension physiology takes a while to build and present. Like remember, you got to collapse the entire lung and then you got to build up enough pressure where we start moving things and causing that.
Yep.
Most of us don't see that pre-hospital. Even though we think we do, it's like, oh, diminished lung sounds, go. It's diminished is not tension pathophys, right? It's diminished, right? Stop. Anyway.
What about thoracostomies? Yes,
I personally think yes. I think paramedics across the board, that should just be standard of care, again, when necessary. And I think...
Okay, so let me ask you this. I don't necessarily disagree with you, but given how long we're potentially with someone... If we're performing a thoracostomy, should we be placing a tube? Because the finger thoracostomy is just a hole.
Correct. I think this could go back to the it depends situation. How long do I have? Mm-hmm. If it's just a couple hours, 6 hours, probably not. Because you can keep opening, you put your occlusive on there, and if you think the tension or the fluid's building back up, you open it back up, squish your finger back in there, and you cover it back up. Is that ideal? Yep. No. Is there a chance we're going to reintroduce more infection and everything else? 100%.
I'm also doing pseudo field surgery on you in the middle of the woods. You're in a bad
But that's place. What I'm saying. We didn't start out clean. I don't care how many alcohol wipes you used. It's going to be a dirty procedure.
Yep.
So it is what it is. Infection's a thing. They're going to get to a hospital. You're going to tell them what you did, and they're going to be like, yeah, they're getting antibiotics anyway. Hopefully you didn't cause anything so bad that they're going to die from that later. But if you did the right thing because you were supposed to and you saved the life for it, then having to get on some antibiotics because of an infection is not that huge a thing in my world. So yes, should you be able to do it? Yes. Now, if you're working one of those remote places where you've got the 18 hours, a few days, yeah, I think the ability to put in a chest tube if necessary to continue to drain is important.
Agreed.
But the only thing I'm going to toss in with a caveat with that is, do you have the blood to support the blood that's being lost if we're putting in chest tubes simply for the fact that they keep losing blood, right? Or if they keep developing tension physiology. Man, if the lung's not fixing itself, holy crap. That's about the only time that keeping the air evacuated. Yeah. Holy crap. So anyway, finger thors. Yeah. I fully support that one. Chest tubes. I would say that would be the specialist places that have folks for multi-day kind of things.
All right. I can get on board with that. iStats, point of care, blood work. Wait, let me guess. It depends.
Again, like in that clinic setting, on my gas oil platform at the Everest Base Camp, sure, 100%. 911, again, wilderness response. What's an iStat going to tell me that I can do anything about? Yep, your lactate's up. Got it. I can't fix that for you. It can confirm some diagnoses I'm thinking about in my head, but it's really not going to help me do much for you.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Like, here's where I landed on this one. It's cool. It's useful. It is a diagnostics confirmation tool more than anything else. It points you in a more specific direction. Unless it's 48 hours plus, the cost of these things and the maintenance of these things and the management of these things doesn't buy us a whole hell of a lot unless we're in an environment where we're managing someone's health for multiple days. Though they're neat, they come with tools that are, if you aren't coming with the full complement of tools to go with them to start managing things like lactate, it's neat, but it's not necessary. And I'd rather save that weight in my backpack for other things, because to go back to my original statement, we are in the business of staving off death. We are not in the business of fixing things. And an iStat more or less feels like a diagnostic tool to get to the right thing to fix stuff, not a stave off death stuff.
And that's where I was going to go with it. Right? It's exactly that. Okay, you're acidotic, and I've got you for 12 or 18 hours. How much bicarb am I legit going to give you that I think is going to do anything? And then have I started messing with your, all the rest of your metabolic processes because I'm dumping bicarb into you that should have stopped 2 amps ago? And who carries that much? It's such a temporizing measure, right? I think even pre-hospitally in the urban 911 systems where it's like, oh, I think they might be acidotic. I gave them an amp of bicarb and it's like, drop in bucket. It's like,
yep.
Cool. That's a rounding. That's one of those drugs I wish we just pull out of the drug boxes for 99% of the use cases. Right? I think there's some probably benefit in some critical care transport stuff, but for the rest of us, it's like, it's one of those, I don't know, they've been down for a while in a cardiac arrest. Should we just give them some bicarb? Sure. Because when do you ever push bicarb, right? As prophylactically, if you have Crest syndrome stuff and you're about to release, but then I don't want to get into all that, but yeah, what's an iStat going to do treatment wise that's going to help me stabilize a patient to get them to definitive care, right? If it's not going to give me enough information for me to be able to treat something, legitimately treat it in that stabilization role, then it's just, yeah, added weight and space that I don't need.
Okay. I tend to agree.
At that point, I think
it's cool to have toys.
Might even be more beneficial.
Say again.
I said at that point, if we're starting to do lab testing, urine dipsticks might be more beneficial for the backcountry provider. Do I see protein and blood in your urine? I do. That's interesting. Not much I can do about it, but I can identify it and I can give you fluids and help see if your kidneys are functioning. Blah,
blah, at least whatever. I know that you're working on dying.
Yeah.
Okay, a couple more. Well, let's talk about this one. Hypertonic saline / mannitol.
I think it should be available simply because a lot of wilderness places find people who fall and have those head injuries. And if they're presenting with, we're starting to swell that brain up, can that 3% or use of mannitol or the combination of all the above help? Again, stabilize them while we get them transported to definitive care where they can get in for surgery and maybe get some pressure relief, etc. Yeah, I don't see why not. Are most of those bags going to go out of date before they get used? Yeah, probably the vast majority of them. But that, in my opinion, is a pretty low cost of benefit thing. Like having a few bags available wouldn't hurt. Like you're going out for a fall patient, grab a bag, toss it in your pack, off you go. And if you find you need it, cool, use that thing. If you get there and you don't need it and you just give them 250 ml of a normal saline bolus just to check fluid and stuff, just as good. It's relatively cheap. Like, why would you not have it available?
Here's the kicker for me. I'm all in for having the medication. It goes directly back to an education program that is absolutely necessary. The one thing that never gets talked about a whole lot with things like mannitol or hypertonic saline is you start at a clock. Mm-hmm. And we know what the end result of that clock, severe dehydration, is ultimately just like where we're headed. I'm not opposed to doing it, but you have to understand and you have to have the knowledge base that if you're going to do it, you've started a clock. And I think as long as there's significant protocols in place to start all the other bits required to solve for that problem, we're okay. But I do know of a number of wilderness programs that are still in the Band-Aid and boo-boo, right? Even with paramedics on staff, right? They're in the Band-Aids and boo-boo fixing mentality. They are not in the critical care level mindset of understanding what they're doing. And in those situations, I don't think it's the right thing to do.
No, I 100%. This is definitely one of those.
And I can only think of two patients. One of which for sure. And the other one I would have been like, I don't know, that you and I have treated in our tenure doing this that would benefit. I can think of a couple more, but on whole, it's again, a high risk, low frequency event. And it is pushing mannitol or hypertonic saline is not a net zero event, right? It does have repercussions if you're wrong.
Oh yeah.
100%. So, or if you don't even have to be wrong, but you know, there's all, if you go too long thing where they're going to die anyway. Right.
But I would say, and this goes back very much to your education piece, is this is not one of those, like with that last case we had with that fall victim, right? Where 100% that patient could have used it long term.
Absolutely would have gotten it had we had it. Yeah.
But it's one of those things of, this is not, you get on scene, go, oh, snap, like this patient, we need some hypertonic for this, right? They're already, like, we know this is a thing. You can't just start giving it now and then your evacuation doesn't start for 8 hours.
Right.
You have to temporize what you can now. And when you know you're getting closer to being able to get out, you start administering that hypertonic, knowing that the evacuation is coming and they're going to get to the hospital. Probably that drip is still going. So then it could be better managed. And again, did you sit with them for 4 hours before that happened? At a certain point, you're just going to have to use some solid provider judgment and say, shit, we can start it now. We can shut it off after a little bit, full of some normal saline. There's a lot of, because the pathophys involved with putting hypertonic into somebody, because it's not just their brain that's being affected. As for my listening fans, it's every cell in the body that's going to be impacted by this sudden increase in the sodium. The whole water follows salt, which means it's coming out of all your cells across the board. It's not just the brain that's being shrunk a little bit. So you got to think about that.
Yeah, I agree. So I think I'll leave that in the, we generally agree, but it's got to come with the education thing.
Yeah, no, it's one of those rare use case, but it wouldn't be a bad thing to have a couple bags around.
I agree. Okay, here's a couple more fun ones related almost exclusively to wilderness. Local anesthesia. I'll lump these together. Local anesthesia and wound closure techniques. And by the way, just for clarity for the three people listening, local anesthesia in my mind includes things like nerve blocks. Oh, you broke your leg, but it's going to be a long extrication. I'd really like to be able to make the leg pain not a thing without loading you up with sedatives or laying
is it without a shitload of ketamine and fentanyl.
Right? Yeah.
All right. I think this is, again, for the austere clinic setting, a potential value. For the wilderness, we'll call it again, 911 EMS response, not so much.
Both? Either? Neither? I lumped them together and now I'm forcing you to talk about them separately because I'm an asshole.
First one, nerve blocks and local anesthesia, I don't think necessary. Could it be handy? Sure. If you got a doc on your team and he's very proficient and he wants to do it because he's going to, I don't know, you shattered your hand and he's going to do something at your wrist to numb you all up nice and happy. Cool. For the rest of us paramedics, holy crap, when are you going to be practicing that one? Like legitimately practicing, not just watching videos on it. I just don't see that at the paramedic level, personally. Again, if you've got a physician and he's an ED physician or whatever, and this is something he's very familiar with and he does fairly regularly and he's comfortable with it, yeah, sure, roll on, doc. Good on you. This is one of those things where I would not involve the paramedic, personally. It's not that it can't be taught. Okay. It's not that they can't learn it. Again, it's how often are you really going to do this? Because there's only so many places you can do nerve blocks. And with local anesthesia, again, what are you what are you giving it for? I guess the only time I would envision myself doing that as a paramedic that's not in a clinical setting would be in the next part of that, part two of wound closure. If I'm going to like doing it simply, either sutures or staples, yeah, it would be nice if I could numb that particular area up to make it a little less uncomfortable, right? By just giving you a global dose of fentanyl or something. But for your normal 911 acute response wilderness thing, I don't think we should be messing with wound closure, especially if it's a fairly sizable thing that you, something that warrants actual wound
I
closure.
I want it to weep and get
staples.
The goo out.
I want to clean it as well as I can. I want to bandage it and keep it clean. But if I close it, if I haven't, and if I don't have access to the antibiotics to give you to prevent the infection that could be coming with me closing all that crap in there, even if I think I've squirted it out and I don't see chunks, I can't physically see bacteria, right? I don't know what I've just closed into your system. And then, yeah, it starts getting infected and weeping, and then somebody else has got to go pull all that shit out, clean it out again. For the average wilderness responder doing the EMS role, no, I don't think wound closure should be a thing. This is definitely more that austere clinic setting where they can go in, do a better debridement or clean out, close it up, and have access to some antibiotics to give you to help prevent that kind of infection occurring. That's just my take.
All right. So it sounds like we're generally on the same page. I went back and forth on this one. I read about some places that do it. Overall, if it's something your team is proficient in, like, who am I to fight you? But at the end of the day, I'm not in the business of closing up a lot of wounds. I think if it's really bad and it needs some staples, like, I could see the argument for some local anesthesia to make it not suck. But
oh yeah, 100%.
But in general, not a thing I care about.
Previous
it's just another
experience,
skill
right?
set to maintain. I know how to bandage wounds. I'm pretty not sucky at it.
The only time I've ever used local anesthesia was literally to then go in with a scalpel and cut at a boil or some sort of other infected nodule on somebody. And that's for my personal use, right? That's the only time I've done it. Because anybody else that's developed even a pretty significant laceration out in the woods somewhere, you clean it up as best you can in the woods, bandage it. And if it's for multiple days, you clean it and bandage it daily, twice daily, whatever you think you can, you got the kit for. And then you get evacuated and then proper clean out comes. And then depending on the wound, it now might not be eligible for stitches or staples. So that is something you need to consider. Because as it begins to heal, it doesn't want to come together and nice and clean anymore because those surface layers, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
So that is a consideration you need to make. But at the same time, if it's healing right and everything's going good, then you can just keep on that path. They can get back and see a local doctor and get it cleaned out. And same thing, bandaged and get antibiotics to make sure it stays healthy and go on about their day. But man, once you close that up, it's not that it's permanent, but you've got to be ready for the consequences following that. And you might not see those. That might be something only your patient now has to deal with. You're like, I did staples in the field. You feel really cool about it. Or I did field suturing because paramedics, we generally don't suture people, right? Even those that work in EDs generally don't suture. Some doc gets to come in and do that.
Yep.
Or some resident. So that's just my personal thing that for those that work, the pre-hospital EMS response, I don't see there being a need for either. But you work those austere clinics, or maybe you're on that very long, month-long expedition. So then, yeah, perhaps both, depending on the needs.
Could be a time and a place there. I agree.
Yeah.
All right. We've largely gotten through my list. There's a couple more minor things like pumps and stuff, but yeah, those are useful. Yeah. Like, I like them. You don't. We've talked about this before.
Well, so it's not that I don't. I just, there's not many medications I'm giving pre-hospitally in the wilderness that require a pump.
That's fair.
Long-term sedation would be fantastic if I'm trying to keep somebody sedated, and because we're bouncing down the trails and all the other stimulus, if I'm keeping that sedation constant, rather than interval bolusing? Yeah, 100%.
Right.
Aside from that, pre-hospitally in the woods, it's not a whole lot that we really need to be doing drips on.
Yeah, that's fair.
I won't say there's not a use case, but it's not. That's a piece of equipment that wouldn't be high on my list of things to buy for a wilderness program.
I was going to make a joke, but I'm gonna hold that off. All right, we're going to call this done. I do want to mention a couple of administrative things, and we probably should have mentioned this at the beginning of the episode. Maybe I'll toss something in at the beginning of the episode. Sean and I are going to be at Fast 24 in North Carolina for anybody that wants to actually meet us in person. I don't know who would listen to this podcast and also go to Fast 24, but if you're one of the three people that listens and you're going to be at Fast 24, so like one of you, you can send us an email at theshow@emsonthemountain.com. And we will try to find a time to link up and talk wilderness medicine and meet you in person. So if you're going to Fast 24 and for whatever reason you're dumb enough to want to meet us, we will be there. So send us a
note. Bring we'll stickers. Find a
time to link up. Yeah, we've got stickers. We'll bring all kinds of cool stuff. All right, with that, I'm going to hit the stop button. So now I'm stopping. If you have any questions or comments or ideas for show topics, you can send us an email at theshow@emsonthemountain.com or hit us up on social media. We can be found on Facebook and Instagram at EMS on the Mountain, Twitter at EMSOTM, or you can engage with us and a whole community of wilderness EMS professionals at locals.com/wilderness EMS.
Until the next episode, thanks for joining us. And until we see you on the mountain, train hard, be safe, and do good work.